rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Be seated. Thank you all. Good morning. Welcome to the Supreme Court. Today is sitting in Coeur d'Alene, Iowa on September 20, 2023 for the second case of the day. Captioned State of Idaho versus Kenneth Kindley III. This matter is brought by Mr. Kindley as appellant and represented here by Douglas Phelps. The state is represented by Justin Porter. But counsel, are there any preliminary matters to the court either of you wish to address before arguing?
Nothing from the appellant.
And none from the state, no.
Very well. Mr. Phelps, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Much of what occurred in this case that the appellant is arguing occurred in pretrial motions on February 25th, 2021 and April 19th of 2021. There was a Zoom appearance on February 25th where Mr. Kindley was in jail and his attorney was on Zoom and the court was also on Zoom. But the later hearing on April 19th, 2021 was also a Zoom hearing where Mr. Kindley was present in the courtroom with the prosecutor and I believe law enforcement on that particular argument. His attorney appeared by Zoom and was not present in the courtroom. And Mr. Kindley was not instructed on how he might converse with the defense attorney or how he might be able to discuss anything that was going on in that motion. That motion involved whether or not the government could use the fact that he had fled the jurisdiction to demonstrate a consciousness of guilt. That was a 402 issue. The court found that it was relevant and it could be used for limited purposes against the defendant to show consciousness of guilt. The defendant, again, was denied his right of counsel because he's unable to communicate. He's not instructed how he might communicate with that counsel. And the court ultimately rules that his flight could be used. Now, the court entered some limitations on how that might be used. And at the trial, they sought to introduce that through an officer that he had fled the jurisdiction for, I believe it was 15 months.
Mr. Phelps, is there anything that indicates that had your client been able to talk to his attorney, there was something that he needed to tell him that would have made a difference in how he argued it?
There's nothing in the record because, well, we can only go by the record at this point. And the record doesn't say that he was instructed how he might communicate with the client or with the attorney. But the fact that he wasn't instructed on how he might communicate with the attorney, it would be our position, shows a fundamental error. Had he been told, you know, we can do go into a breakout room or you might have an opportunity to talk to the attorney through that, then there would be more of a record to indicate that he was advised that there was a way to to go out into the breakout room. But the record doesn't show that he was advised that he could go into a breakout room or have any discussions with the attorney.
So your argument isn't based on any prejudice, then it's based more on the perception that this was fundamental error?
Well, the prejudice, I think, comes from the fact that the court didn't tell him that there was a way for that to occur. And the fact that he's not instructed demonstrates the prejudice. Had court, and I myself have conducted hearings in that county and other counties where the court says, now look, if you want to talk to your attorney, we have the ability to set you out in the breakout room. That didn't happen in this case. So our position that that demonstrates a fundamental error by not advising him how he might utilize his rights to an attorney in a hearing conducted on the Zoom hearing, where normally you would expect the defendant and his representative counsel to be there in the same room where they could talk back and forth and issues that he wants the defense attorney to argue and that sort of thing might have a conversation about that. He was denied that. And our argument that the record demonstrates that he was denied that because that colloquy between the court and him didn't occur in this case. But many other errors have occurred.
Just so I'm clear about, are you asserting, when you mentioned the 25th of February hearing, is that the hearing that you think is operative here in terms of the violation? Is there some other general reference? I think the brief says that at several points during the life of the case, Kimberly and his counsel separately appeared remotely, which I take to mean both were on Zoom, but not specifically only on the February 25th, which as I read it was a pretrial conference.
I believe that was record that I looked at indicates on April 19, 2021, there was a motion in limine that was conducted on Zoom, and I think that's where many of the errors begin in this case.
Is that referenced in your brief?
It is, Your Honor. April 19, 2021 was a motion in limine, okay. And that's where they failed to discuss if they could confer by Zoom.
All right. Thank you for that clarification.
And I appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor. And then the court ruled in written order that they could use for limited purposes the flight where he was gone for 15 months. That thread continued throughout the trial where the prosecutor brings out through a police officer that he had fled the district for 15 months and was out of the district to show consciousness of guilt. The defense again objected to that, but the trial court allowed it to be entered. And then in subsequent testimony, his girlfriend appeared at the trial and testified about their relationship and the relationship with the children involved in this case. During that testimony, the prosecutor questioned her about whether or not she had assisted him in fleeing the jurisdiction during that 15-month absence. She, at that point, asserted her Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, and the court asked her if she was. She said that she was, and then prosecutor in closing arguments raised with the jury that her assertion of the Fifth Amendment right was worse than bias. It was much worse than bias, and that recognizing that she had a constitutional right to assert the Fifth Amendment. But he argued to the jury that her assertion of the Fifth Amendment right was worse than bias. He's essentially, our argument is, well, ultimately, it's the cumulative effect of all of these errors. It's prosecutorial misconduct to use that constitutional assertion of a Fifth Amendment right to imply guilt onto Mr. Kimberly and her in the matter not really related. Whether or not she assisted him in fleeing the state for the 15 months that they're asserting he was out of the state after he was charged. So we have the assertion that the and the second part of the analysis under 404B, the prosecutor, there was no finding that I could see in the record where the court found that rule on whether or not the introduction of consciousness of guilt by showing a flight from the jurisdiction was not unduly prejudicial. Certainly the court made a ruling regarding relevance, but didn't, from the record that I could find, show anything where the court found that it was not unduly prejudicial. And I would point out that this is one case where the defense attorney did object, again, during the trial, the introduction of that evidence into the record. So, again, we argue the prosecutor committed prosecutorial misconduct in misrepresenting the facts and using unnecessarily inflammatory tactics consistent with State v. Miller, 165, Idaho 115, a 2019 case.
Mr. Phelps, can you address the State's contention that on both the prosecutorial misconduct and the failure to advise the defendant of how he can speak with his counsel at a couple of hearings, the failure to object below on those, and the failure to assert fundamental error in the opening brief means those claims are waived on appeal?
You know, I thought about it. This is the problem with these arguments not being made in the district court. The defendants here, essentially unrepresented, in a courtroom with the prosecutor and the government's witnesses, his attorney is somewhere else, we don't know, appearing on Zoom, and he's relying on that attorney who, I don't know, maybe somehow benefited from not having to be in the courtroom with the defendant. And he is, under this fundamental error, relying upon the same attorney that's not present in the courtroom to assert his right to have that effective assistance of counsel. So essentially, Mr. Kimberly, where the court didn't advise him, where the court fails to advise him of that right, is at the mercy of the attorney who is not present in the courtroom.
And I understand that argument on the failure to object below, but what do we do? Let me back up. Did you assert a fundamental error argument on either the failure to advise him he could break out with his attorney or prosecutorial misconduct? Did you assert fundamental error on those issues in your opening brief?
I believe that we did. Now, I know the government asserts otherwise, but in my opinion, my humble opinion, maybe that's where I'm ineffective, is that we did argue under my interpretation, understanding the law, by asserting that argument, we did.
Can you tell me what pages of your brief you asserted fundamental error on those two issues?
I can't right now. I would but certainly use the remainder of my time to try and find that and answer that, you know, with more reflection while counsel does his argument. The defendants in these cases are at the mercy of their defense counsel, particularly when they're not in the courtroom together, so he can't ask questions or address the court. And when there just isn't an attorney there, he's not trained in the law. He doesn't understand what will happen if he does, or what he can say. And oftentimes when they try to say something, the court will advise them rightly so. So you have an attorney, I'd advise you that you talk to your attorney. Now, I guess maybe to answer the earlier question, the fact that he doesn't say anything could, I guess, be interpreted as a failure on his part to assert that Sixth Amendment right. But he wasn't, at that hearing, he wasn't advised of that right either.
I want to circle back, counsel, to your comment about the Rule 404B for analysis for just a moment. You kept referencing the fact that the evidence was unduly prejudicial. unfair, and that's a 403 balancing test, correct?
Well, I think it was both, and particularly in the case where the prosecutor, in closing arguments, pulls in not only something that may not be relevant, arguably isn't relevant, but certainly is unduly prejudicial when he says her Fifth Amendment assertion regarding that particular issue of flight being a consciousness of guilt compounds the error as it goes to the jury.
I don't understand your relevance argument on that at all. Proof of flight has been a part of our jurisprudence dating back to the Roman era, where there was the old legal maxim that he who flees admits guilt. Now there's exceptions to that. I mean, this is not an alien concept that was introduced just in this case. For centuries, proof of flight has been admitted and has been found to be relevant. Why wouldn't it have been relevant here?
I think the court ruled, and probably rightly so, it was relevant. But the question is, was it unduly prejudicial or unfairly prejudicial, as you mentioned?
So are you admitting now that it was relevant, or I heard you argue it wasn't relevant. I'm trying to understand that argument.
Well, on the record that was there, I don't know that there was any demonstration of why he fled, or what the circumstances of that were. We did get later information where the prosecutor suggests or argues that her assertion of her Fifth Amendment right for the girlfriend that she may have assisted him in his flight, but that only came out in the end of the trial. And then the bigger problem is the prosecutor's argument that demonstrated some high degree of bias, or greater than bias, by her assertion of her
consciousness. Isn't the bigger issue here that the prosecutor's argument is inconsistent with Idaho Criminal Jury Instruction 316?
It is. And I'm not sure what the prosecutor... He's a skilled prosecutor. I know him well. He's the elected prosecutor up there. We all get overzealous at time in trial, and that's the only thing that I can think of why he would have done that. I think I have a high degree of respect for him. So he's the elected prosecutor up there, and he's a skilled attorney, but sometimes you just get carried away in trial. And this is clearly, I think, one of those cases where that clearly happened. So my argument is that the string of errors in this case relates back to April 19, 2021, and the argument about the admission of the evidence of flight. And it's important in the record that the court made limitations on how the prosecutor might argue that, or how they might use that evidence. And the prosecutor, in his closing argument, violated that order that the court had entered in a written ruling subsequent to the April 19th, 2021 hearing.
I've heard you mention several times now the phrase string of errors. One time you used the phrase cumulative error. Have you ever asserted cumulative error?
We did it on a reply brief. We
asserted cumulative error. Reply brief, but not in your opening brief.
No, not in the opening brief. We did not. I'll reserve the balance of my time unless somebody has a question that I haven't addressed. I will look at it, see if I can find. The question I believe was if we had, I'm sorry.
On what pages of your appellant's brief did you assert fundamental error with regard to the failure to advise and consult with his attorney in the prosecutorial misconduct?
I'll look that up and try and address that.
Thank you.
Anything?
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sir. May it please the court and counsel, Mr. Kimberly has raised five claims of error on appeal in this case, and I intend to address 5 in the order in which they appear in the briefs. As to his first claim, he raises a claim of fundamental error with respect to his right to a public trial. Now, in order to show a fundamental error, he must show that there was a violation of at least one or more unwaived constitutional rights. He must show that the error is clear and obvious from the record, and that the error is clear under existing law. That under that second prong of the fundamental error test, there must be no need for additional information that's not in the appellate record, including information on whether the failure to object was a tactical decision by trial counsel. And finally, the defendant must show error, that the error affected the outcome of the proceedings. Now, I intend to take an unorthodox approach with respect to this first claim of error. I intend to address these prongs in reverse order, and hopefully that my argument will make clear as to why I'm doing that. As to the third prong, the state argued in its brief that Mr. Kimbley had failed to show that the alleged violation of his right to a public trial affected the outcome of the proceedings. Now, I have a colleague who likes to use this. He says this a lot. He says that he always feels that he's a better attorney 6 months after, inevitably feels that he's a better attorney 6 months after he writes his brief. And in this instance, I feel that that applies to me, because the third prong obviously does not apply to the right to a violation of the right to a public trial, because that is a structural error. So I would concede that that portion of my brief, I believe it's page 16 on page 17, is irrelevant to the question here. But nevertheless, the state still asserts that Mr. Kimbley has failed to demonstrate a fundamental error with respect to his right to a public, violation of his right to a public trial. Under the second prong, he didn't address the second prong at all in his opening briefing. There's no argument whatsoever that the error was clear and obvious from the record. There's no argument that the decision not to object to the modified courtroom proceedings was not a tactical decision on the part of his defense counsel. He has cited and relied on outside authority to try to prove his point that this was a violation of his right to counsel. And he has not cited to any legal authority that unequivocally resolves this issue in his favor. In fact, in the state's opening brief, the state provided a string cite that really cuts against his argument that video live streaming the trial constitutes a violation of the right to a public trial. As to the first prong, if this court were to get to the first prong, with respect to the first prong, he hasn't shown a violation of the right to a public trial under Waller. Again, that goes to the weight of all of the cases cited by the state support the contention that what the district court did in this instance really complied with this court's emergency order and complied with the Waller case. And therefore, the state again asserts that Mr. Kimbley has failed to show fundamental error with respect to this claim. His second claim is that he was denied the right to counsel because at two pretrial hearings, one was a motion in limine and one was a motion to sever for prejudicial joinder, that he appeared in one instance, he was in the courtroom while his trial counsel appeared via Zoom, and then the other instance he appeared, I'm assuming via WebEx, from the jail, and his counsel appeared via Zoom. The state's assertion here is that, again, Mr. Kimbley has failed to demonstrate fundamental error. He hasn't argued or asserted any argument with respect to the second or third prongs of the fundamental error test. I believe in reply he attempted to argue that the fact that these claims were ones of, with respect to this and the prosecutorial misconduct, that because he raised these claims as claims of constitutional dimension, that that's sufficient to invoke fundamental error review. Well, even if this court were to construe his arguments as one of fundamental error, he's failed to demonstrate under the second and third prongs that fundamental error actually occurred here. And that's his burden to do so. He's asking this court to do a lot of heavy lifting in searching the record, in looking for authority that would support his proposition in order to satisfy the second and third prongs of the fundamental error test.
Thinking about hearings conducted via Zoom and WebEx in the future, moving forward, in your experience, and this really has little to do with this case, but much more thinking of our system moving forward, are defendants and their counsel given the opportunity
opportunity to use those breakout rooms, and are they being advised that that option is available so that they can communicate with one another privately?
Your Honor, in all candor to the court, I don't think...
Please continue.
I think you were telling me that you're not the right guy to talk to.
That's the gist of it, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Porter, are you seeing any mention in transcripts of hearings or trials conducted during the pandemic, because now they're filtering through on appeal, when you're reading the transcripts, are you seeing judges advising the defendant that if they want to talk to their lawyer, they can be put in a breakout room?
None come to the top of my mind, Your Honor, and ultimately, I think if we step back, the ultimate question that is at issue before the court in this case is whether, the narrow question is whether Mr. Kimbley has provided authority that imposes such a duty on the district court, and he hasn't. Therefore, he has failed to demonstrate fundamental error under the second prong at a minimum.
Well, I want to make sure I understand the facts in this case. Is there any indication that the judge told the defendant that he couldn't speak to his attorney?
No, Your Honor.
And so there could have been a room available if they had asked, if the defendant said, I'd like to speak with my attorney, or if the attorney said, I'd like to speak with my client.
Frankly, Your Honor, I think the record is somewhat silent on that point. But ultimately, what the record does show is that there wasn't any objection from the defendant. There was no indication on the record that he was requesting.
What is what I'm getting at. I mean, it would have been one thing if the judge said, sorry, we have no rooms available on Zoom to allow private consultation. You're not going to be able to talk to your attorney. I think that's very different than this case where it appears the subject didn't even come up.
Right, that's the point I was trying to make, Your Honor. That it didn't come up. There's no indication that Mr. Kimbley wanted to speak with his attorney, needed to speak with his attorney, and was prevented from doing so.
I guess what I'm trying to say is there was no objection because there was no request that had been denied. Right? There's no reason for a defendant to object to something unless he's tried to do it and been denied.
Correct, but that brings us to fundamental error, and still he hasn't demonstrated that the non-objected to error below is one of constitutional dimension that requires reversal on appeal because it amounts to fundamental error.
I guess what I'm saying is the only way that we could find error here would be is if the judge incorrectly advised the defendant that he wouldn't be able to talk to his attorney.
Right, Your Honor, and the state does not downplay the significance of such a claim, but that claim is not the one that's being raised here. I guess unless there are further questions as to that second argument, I would move on to the next claim of error, which is that the district court improperly admitted evidence of Mr. Kimbley's pretrial flight from prosecution. The state's position here is that the district court was correct in its pretrial ruling that this evidence was admissible under Rule 404B. There was sufficient evidence in the record, and that's laid out in the district court's order, that showed that Mr. Kimbley had indeed fled the jurisdiction prior to his trial. Again, going back to Justice Mueller's point from opposing counsel's opening argument, it's well established in Idaho law that consciousness of that evidence of flight is relevant to knowledge of and consciousness of guilt. Mr. Kimbley has not provided any authority that suggests otherwise. In terms of conducting the 403 balancing test, the district court conducted that test, and ultimately it narrowly tailored its ruling in allowing the admission of evidence of Mr. Kimbley's pretrial flight. It ruled that the state could not ask about whether he had used an alias while he was on the land, whether he was working under the table, or have the detective give an opinion as to the reason for Mr. Kimbley's flight. During trial, the state did, in its opening statement, advise the jury that Mr. Kimbley was, as part of his explanation for why this case had taken so long from the disclosure until the actual trial occurred, did comment on the fact that part of that was Mr. Kimbley leaving the jurisdiction for, I believe it was approximately 17 months. During the trial, the state did call Detective Reining, and his testimony was limited to the fact that Mr. Kinley had failed to appear after he posted his bond at a subsequent pretrial conference, and that he wasn't reapprehended until, again, 17 months later.
As I read the appellant's brief, he seems to take issue with the 17-month part of the evidence. And would you address that specifically, the time, the length, that telling the jury the length of time that he was gone?
Well, for...
unfairly prejudicial.
Right. I don't think it was unfairly prejudicial. I think the district court was correct that for one, this wasn't outside the scope of the district court's ruling, and two, it was relevant because it was necessary to explain to the jury why this case had languished for, I believe it was 10 years between the alleged conduct and the trial, and then several years in between the charging of the case and ultimately taking it to trial. I just don't think that necessarily saying that, you know, I think we need to look at the purpose for which the evidence was introduced to determine how prejudicial it is. And the state never commented on it during its closing argument. It merely talked about it during an opening statement, again, to explain to the jury, look, we charged this case in, I don't remember exactly, 2014 or 2015, and now we're not into trial until 2021. And part of that is because Mr. Kinley did not show up to any of his court proceedings. He wasn't in the jurisdiction for certain.
Again, you just used the phrase to see how prejudicial it was. Once again, do you agree with my point? It's not an issue of whether it's unduly prejudicial, it's whether it's unfairly prejudicial.
Yes.
And you agree there's a difference there. For example, a confession might be unduly prejudicial, but we let confessions in because they are highly relevant.
Right. Right. And
not unfair.
Right. And I don't think anything about the length of time that Mr. Kinley was on the lam is unfairly prejudicial.
So the unfairly component in the Rule 403 balancing test would apply to the restrictions, the limitations the judge placed on the use of this evidence. In other words, the judge was trying to let it come in, but in a fair way.
Right. And again, I think that one important thing to note here is that this court has said that Rule 403 errs on the side of admitting the evidence. And that's why the term unfairly, I think, is used rather than unduly.
So Rule 401 and 402 suggest that all evidence that's relevant is admissible,
right,
unless it can be shown otherwise.
Right. And unless there are further questions, I move on to the fourth claim of error, which is that the district court erred in admitting evidence that Mr. Kinley had at some point possessed a firearm. Now, I think that this claim of error is invited error, and I think Mr. Kinley has conceded as much in his reply brief. I believe it's on page 14. He essentially concedes in reply that it was him who first introduced evidence that he had possessed a firearm during the trial. It was during cross-examination of the victim, and it was in an attempt to impeach the victim witness. And essentially, because he has conceded the invited error doctrine, applies to this claim of error, I don't have anything else to say on that unless there are questions.
Well, I took his argument on reply to be that although he introduced it for impeachment purposes, the court erred when it allowed the questioning by the prosecutor. He alleges that exceeded what was needed to rehabilitate the witness by going into details about, you know, where he carried the gun and how it looked and all that. So maybe if you want to speak to that point.
I guess that's not how I interpreted the reply brief, but to the extent that is what Mr. Kinley is arguing, I don't necessarily think that that's the argument that was raised in the opening brief. I think what was raised is that this was a violation of Rule 404B generally, not a violation of the district court's 404B ruling. So to the extent that's a new argument raised in the reply brief, I would say that he's waived that argument and that the court should not reverse on this claim on that basis.
Independent of the fact that the defense opened the door, wasn't one of the theories of the case that, at least the state's posture, was that the delay of either victim coming forward would be because they were intimidated and afraid of the defendant?
Yes.
So wouldn't evidence of firearms be relevant for that purpose?
It would have been, Your Honor. But because the state wasn't the one who introduced the evidence, there wasn't an objection at trial for the state to make that argument below. So, essentially.
So I'm just guessing it wouldn't be harmless because it would have been admissible for
certainly
at least one other purpose.
Certainly. Unless there are further questions, I'd like to use the remainder of my time to discuss the fifth claim of error, which is a claim of prosecutorial misconduct. Again, the state's argument here is that this claim is unpreserved to the extent it's not raised as a claim of fundamental error. And again, to the extent Mr. Kinley has now asserted that it was raised as a claim of fundamental error, he has failed to demonstrate fundamental error because he has not argued all of the prongs of the fundamental error test. Mr. Kinley did not object during the trial to the prosecutor's rebuttal closing argument. Therefore, he has to raise this claim as one of fundamental error. And again, he has not done so because he did not mention the fundamental error standard in his opening brief with respect to this claim. Even a generous reading of his argument reveals, again, the same fatal beef that is present with respect to his second claim of error. He has to show that there is authority. He has to show the error that's clear in the record. He has to show authority unequivocally resolves the issue in his favor. He has to show that there was no reasonable tactical decision to be made by his trial counsel in failing to object. He has not done so, and he has not argued that the error affected the outcome of the proceeding. And because he failed to do that, again, he's asking this court to do the heavy lifting, to find those two prongs, despite the fact that he did not raise them in his opening brief. And again, I believe this is where he explicitly says that it was sufficient to raise this as one of fundamental error simply by virtue of the fact that he claims it's a constitutional violation. But again, that's not what Perry requires. He is required to cite the fundamental error standard and to, well, at a minimum, to argue all three prongs of the fundamental error standard. He failed to do so. I have one last comment about the argument that the cumulative effect of these errors.
Before we get there,
sure.
Let's assume we somehow get past this argument that you just asserted that it wasn't properly raised in the opening brief. Do you not agree, though, that this was pretty egregious error on the part of the prosecutor and the court erred in not immediately giving Idaho Criminal Jury Instruction 316 instruction to the jury at that time?
I think that, I guess I'll try to work my way backwards, if I may. With respect to whether the court should have given a jury instruction, because it wasn't objected to, I'm not exactly sure how it would have worked. I don't know if the district court would have had a duty sua sponte to pull that jury instruction and to provide it to the jury. And on top of that, I had this question earlier today as I was preparing for argument, and I couldn't remember whether the jury instructions were in the record. So I went searching the record for the jury instructions. I don't believe that the jury instructions that the court actually gave to the jury are in our record. So it is possible the district court provided this jury instruction to...
Was the transcript in the record?
The transcript is in the record, Your Honor, but in the transcript there's a bracketed sentence that says whereupon the court read the jury instructions to the jury. So the record is not clear on precisely what jury instructions were provided.
What about the jury instruction conference? Can you tell from the jury instruction conference which instructions were given? The reason I ask is I can't imagine I wouldn't have mentioned all of those in my jury instruction conference.
Your Honor, I did not scroll up to that portion of the transcript. So it is possible that it's...
I would assume that it wasn't on the pre-suggested jury instructions that were going to be read, because 316 is usually only read if the issue comes up. If someone makes an improper argument during closing argument, then the 316 instruction would become very relevant. Don't you agree?
Yes. If the state improperly comments on, you know, vouches for a witness or commits prosecutorial misconduct in another way, then that jury instruction would be relevant. I guess there is the potential that jury instruction 316 is discussed in a different portion of the trial transcript that I didn't look at this morning. So it is possible it's in there. I apologize for not being as prepared as perhaps I should have on that point. But going back to, you know,
was there any kind of cautionary instruction given by the judge at the time the Fifth Amendment was inserted in front of the jury?
No, I don't believe there was.
Because, again, that's an instance where I think many judges, myself included, would have given the 316 instruction as soon as the witness in front of the jury asserted the Fifth Amendment.
And I guess this issue never occurred when I was a trial practitioner, when I was a prosecutor. So I'm trying to think about whether the district court would have done so sua sponte. It sounds like Your Honor would have.
Let's put this in context. The witness is testifying. The witness has asked a question. The witness says, I can't answer that because we're in litigation. The judge says, are you asserting your Fifth Amendment right? Yes. The jury's sitting there hearing all this. Do you think the jury wasn't entitled to some explanation at that point about whether they should consider that or not, or to what degree they could consider that?
Perhaps they were, Your Honor. Defense counsel hasn't argued that on appeal. That's ultimately not the issue before this court.
Do you think as a prosecutor, given their special stewardship over justice, even when they're prosecuting a defendant, do you think that the prosecution should have asked for a 360 instruction? And instead of doing just the opposite, stating the opposite of Rule 316 in the closing argument?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but again, that's not the claim that has been raised. I think those are all they're interesting questions, and the state is not attempting to downplay the importance of the defendant's right to a fair trial, the significance of a claim of prosecutorial misconduct. Ultimately, what the state is here to argue is that in order to show prosecutorial misconduct in this case, the defendant needed to establish fundamental error, and he has failed to do so.
And I understand your argument. I obviously have a bird in my saddle about this issue.
Unless there are further questions on that point, I just close by saying the cumulative error argument is raised for the first time in the reply brief, and because of that, it's waived. Counsel, again, has raised that argument in oral argument today, but again, because it's not raised in his opening brief, it's waived, and the court shouldn't consider it and definitely should not rule against the state on a claim that we didn't have a fair opportunity to respond to in the briefing. And unless there are further questions, I would ask this court to affirm the judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time does he not have remaining?
11
minutes.
I'll try not to use it all, but
could I interrupt right before you start? I guess part of the concern I have, just apart from preservation and all the rest on the fifth claim of error, is you talked about the respect you have for the prosecutor and the egregious error he made in talking about the right against self-incrimination, but doesn't the defense attorney also have an obligation in that egregious setting, this scream and shout about it, to the point that there's an objection made and the judge is triggered to give the instruction? Part of the third case on fundamental error talks about sandbagging. And I don't know if you're down the road closing argument, you're seeing how bad this is going for your client, and you just sit there and don't say a thing, then hey, we'll get this on appeal because I sandbag, and then they'll come back to me on post-conviction. How do we know it wasn't a tactical question? And where do we start the clock?
I was not the trial lawyer. I wish I were. But I've been making a lot more.
Well, I'm not asking you to define that out of thin air. It seems to me that this goes both ways. You talk about the prosecutor in respect for the prosecutor, and I just think, boy, the defense attorney didn't say words. Let that go. Is that an evidence of the sandbagging? And therefore, even if you preserved this, if I really doubt you did, can we get past the middle problem? Maybe this was a tactical question at that point.
I can't imagine a defense attorney making that as a defense attorney. I can't imagine a defense attorney thinking, oh, this is going to wow, this is going to help us. I just see no way that would ever help them. I would have been objecting and saying, when that witness asserted the Fifth Amendment, maybe the answer to one of the earlier questions, I'd have been jumping up and down and saying, Judge, you need to give a limiting instruction to the jury on this. And then, kind of putting the prosecutor on notice, you shouldn't be bringing this up. because the court's going to give us limiting instruction, the instruction to the jury on it. I can't imagine a defense attorney making a tactical decision to do that. And Judge Jensen, who's now a district court judge, who is a trial judge in this case, probably looks on it a little differently. I can't imagine as a defense attorney making a tactical decision at the end of the trial when that's being brought up again by the prosecutor that, oh, this is good for my client, I'm going to let it go. I can't explain that. And I'm going to try and answer the earlier question. I looked at my brief and I think the question was, did we argue the fundamental error on the Sixth Amendment, 14th Amendment violation?
Your second and fifth.
Oh, the same.
Yeah.
And page 18 of our brief, in the first paragraph, we argue the Sixth and 14th Amendment to the criminal defendant, a fundamental right of counsel in order to ensure a fair trial. We cite Gideon versus Wainwright, and then we point out the denial of counsel's ability to confer and consult with the accused and prepare his defense converts the appointment of counsel into a sham, and it becomes nothing more than a formal compliance with the Constitution, the requirement that an accused be given the assistance of counsel, citing Avery versus Alabama. And then we, in that paragraph, close out with, the courts have found a constructive denial of counsel when counsel appearing remotely at an initial appearance did not have the opportunity to speak with counsel during the hearing, citing Tucker et al. Versus Idaho, 162 Idaho 11, 2017 case.
And so I see those pages. I see that you're arguing his constitutional rights were violated, but what I'm not seeing is a citation on those second and fifth claims of error, citation to the fundamental error analysis, to Perry, any analysis of the four factors. Am I missing that? Do you believe you argued those factors on the second and fifth?
I believe in arguing that it's a fundamental right, that we're essentially arguing that this is a fundamental right, and the cases that we cite after that demonstrate or actually say that that the appointment of counsel without access to counsel is a denial of that fundamental right.
Let me try to interpret what you're saying here. Are you suggesting then that by claiming that it's a constitutional violation, that's tantamount to saying it's fundamental error?
I agree, yes. That's what when the case law that we cite calls it a fundamental right, and it's a fundamental right to ensure a fair trial, I don't know how much more clearly you can set out that that's a fundamental error. You have a right to counsel, but you don't get to talk to that counsel during your initial appearance, and you don't get to talk to that counsel during an argument on an issue related to the introduction of, you know, very serious evidence that then results in additional evidence coming in and other facts coming in at the trial that leave a question of whether or not the jury was responding to the allegations or was the jury responding to the a witness assertion of the Fifth Amendment right, or were they responding to this argument that he pled the jurisdiction, or did they believe that he committed the crime? All of this evidence is coming in, and the defendant attorney, I don't know why they're not arguing that, but the defendant is not a lawyer. He's sitting in a room with the people that are accusing him of a crime during multiple hearings and not being advised that there's a method for him to communicate with his attorney. And is that on him? Or is that on the court that that the court has to advise him, well, you have a right to an attorney, and that ensures, that includes the right to talk to that attorney.
Well, but court proceedings take place every day where a defendant is sitting next to his attorney, and the judge never looks at the attorney and says, if you two want to confer, you may do so. There's no need to tell them that.
But if they're sitting there next to each other, all that's required is for him to look over and whisper to the attorney. You need to know.
I understand that it's easier. I'm just wondering, if we rule how you want us to, we're creating now a new rule that says if a judge is in a remote proceeding, he has to advise the defendant of his right to consult with his attorney in a private setting. That's an advisory now a judge would have to give if we rule the way you want us to rule.
Well, I can tell you, I practice every day in Idaho, and often on Zoom. And my observation is that more and more frequently, not always, but more and more frequently, the judges will say, you know, your counsel's appearing on Zoom, you have a right to confer with him, we can put you in a breakout room if you want to do that.
I don't take my question wrong, because I have a feeling that is the best practice, and it's probably something we want to do. My issue is, do we want to create that as a legal standard of constitutional proportion?
I'm not going to argue. As a practicing attorney, I'm hesitant to argue against Zoom hearings. Maybe they shouldn't occur, but I think there's a good deal of convenience for the prosecutors in having the defendants appear at the jail. They don't have to transport them but to court and back and those sorts of things. But to ensure the defendant gets his rights, I think it would be a good practice to advise judges, you know you have a right to have your attorney here. We can put you in a breakout room, or if we're not going to be able to have your attorney here, we'll continue this hearing to another day. As a practical matter, I think that would be much better to ensure the defendants their right to counsel. And in Mr. Kindley's place, imagining I'm there, I'm educated in the practice of law, in a room with everybody that's after me and nobody that's supposed to be for me, they're not trained in the practice of law. Is that on him, or is that on the court? My position, it should be on the court. And Mr. Kimball was not advised. I think that you, I don't know if I've answered the question that you had, Your Honor, but unless you have some other questions, I'm done. Almost done. Anything? Thank you for allowing me to argue today. Good for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate each of you. Time today, the matter is now under advisement.